I have the opposite of stage fright. I have, like, solitude fright. Show me an audience, let me know how they're reacting to what I'm doing, and I'm much happier.
It's interesting. I feel like theater and radio are similar in the way that there's kind of a repetition to doing it every night. Like with theater, you're going up and doing the same show every night. And with radio, you're expected to provide kind of the same experience every week. That's why people tune in.
Yes.
But it's just those like little crazy variations that make it exciting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we, you know, we have a, you know, people want to tune in to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and hear pretty much the same show, or at least the same people doing the same kind of thing. And we provide that. But I love it myself personally when something kind of goes off the rails, because it's kind of exciting and interesting. And we're hoping that, you know, some huge disaster befalls us on May 2nd, so it becomes a quite memorable live event.
Do you have kind of a disaster that you look back on fondly that happened when you were doing the show?
You know, people ask me that, and I don't know what it is, but the answer is really no. We've never had something go so fantastically wrong that we couldn't recover and do our show. Probably the worst thing that's ever happened to us, and I say this advisedly knowing it's not that bad, is we made the mistake of interviewing Gene Simmons.
You're not the first public radio show to do that.
The difference, you know, Gene Simmons, for your listeners who don't know, is, of course, the guy who founded KISS, the one with the tongue, if you will. And he had a famous interview with Terry Gross that really is in the Radio Interview Hall of Fame, because he was just as obnoxious and vicious and profane and vulgar and horrible to Terry as he was to us. The difference is that Terry broadcast the whole thing. It's like, this is the guy, this is what he said to me, this is what he said, and it was just amazing to hear somebody be that insanely rude and stupid to a beloved figure like Terry Gross, who gave as good as she got, by the way. But we couldn't believe the stupid, vicious, anti-Semitic, misogynistic, sexist things he was saying. So we basically cut the whole interview. And so, you know, our interview with Gene Simmons is like 30 seconds long. But it was pretty traumatic to go through. I will always remember the silence in our studio where we were doing this when he finally was off the line. And we were like, oh, my God. We had some panelists threaten to quit. They were so upset by him.
That's surprising to hear anti-Semitic. I've never heard that about
Gene
Simmons.
Yeah, well, considering, especially because he's Jewish.
Yeah.
I would tell you what he said, but, you know, it would probably get you in touch with the FCC.
I appreciate the restraint.
Okay.
One of the signatures of the show is basically bringing on famous people and making them do something really unusual. I think my favorite in that realm is the time you had Salman Rushdie on to talk about Pez dispensers.
That was a long time ago, but yes, we were trying to get him on recently to see if he'd learned anything about Pez dispensers, but he had to cancel at the last minute.
That's a shame. I'm sure he probably has been studying them since last time.
Well, you know,
there's
kind of a serious point to that, and I say this both as somebody who has interviewed a lot of people and been interviewed in my time, that there's a tendency to both ask and answer the same questions. And it becomes a little routine for everybody. I mean, how many times can person X tell the same story or whatever? So if you ask somebody like Salman Rushdie about Pez dispensers, or if you ask, as more recently happened, Bill Clinton about the TV show My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, there'll be a wonderful moment where he'll go, no one's ever done this to me before. And we'll say, no one's ever done this to you before. And you sort of make a little bit of silly history. And everybody enjoys it, I think.
I think what's interesting, I remember that I was about to ask you about that Bill Clinton one, because you kind of see a little bit of the person's personality that you wouldn't normally see. Like Bill Clinton being game to talk about
exactly
obsessive
right.
My Little Pony fans is so much more telling than asking him, hey, why don't you talk about your accomplishments as president, which is something
right.
that he talks about every, you know, 15 minutes.
And I love doing that. If there's one thing I love best about my job, it may be that, which is that I get to take well-known people and show a different side of them to the public.
In terms of the tone of the show, I mean, when you came on NPR, it really did sound like nothing else that was on NPR and still does to some extent. How is the adjustment kind of bringing a silly show, a show that is, you know, that talks about the news and talks about current events, but is, you know, substantially less serious than anything else on the air? How was that transition received when you started doing it?
Well, I mean, it was a little weird, but it wasn't as difficult as you might think. For one thing, everybody at NPR, including the most serious, sonorous voices you can think of, are pretty funny, smart people. You know, Robert Siegel, for example. And they know, Scott Simon, another great example, and they know that they can't be silly on the air. That's not their jobs. It's not what people expect or really, I think, want from them. And the fact that we can, that's our job, if you will, has always gotten a lot of support from NPR, both, you know, management and other people. They're like, we're glad you're doing what you're doing. And you'd think, like, people would be like, why are you hurting our brand? And over the years, you know, we're an odd little beast. We live in Chicago and work in Chicago away from the other NPR, you know, people in Washington, New York, and L.A. And we're sort of NPR, but not at NPR, and I think that helps us. I think people enjoy us because we're like the really amusing cousin who comes every now and then to have dinner with you and your family on holidays, and everybody loves to see him because he's so funny and weird, and he always has great stories to tell. But secretly, everybody is glad they don't live with him.
Yeah,
that's us. We're the weird, adorable cousin who is always fun to see.
I wonder. This is kind of a serious question because NPR does have kind of a playful spirit on a lot of the shows, and sometimes, especially because your show does deal with the news, you kind of have to bump up against a national mood that really doesn't want to laugh. Like, I mean, particularly last week after everything that happened in Boston.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you handle that tonally? Like, how do you approach it
that
when something has happened?
Tricky. It's really tricky. And you'd be surprised, or maybe you wouldn't be, how much sometimes we talk about this. It just so happens that last week happened during a scheduled week off. And so with some relief, we realized we wouldn't have to deal with it. Although we did talk about the Boston bombing on this week's show. You know, our general rule is if it's in the news, we'll try to talk about it. We'll try to be careful not to make fun of people who were injured, damaged in any way, physically or otherwise, through no fault of their own, you know? And if we can do that, if we can find the humor in a situation that's tragic, I think we do a favor if we do it well, because there's almost always something goofy or funny about any situation. So, for example, in this situation in Boston, you know, we talked about the fact that, you know, America, you know, found out there were Chechen bombers, apparently, or bombers from Chechnya, and they were like, everybody confused them with Czechoslovakia and, excuse me, the Czech Republic, and the Czech embassy had to put out a statement saying, no, we're different. And that we thought was funny. But stuff like that. And I think if we can do that, you know, our listeners enjoy it in particular because they get a break.
So what can people expect at the cinema event?
Well, it's going to be a great show. I mean, we have, first of all, some usual elements, myself and Carl Castle, plus our panelists Tom Baudet, Paula Poundstone, and Mo Rocca, three of people's favorites. But we also have a musical guest for the first time, the amazingly great funk singer Sharon Jones and her band, the Dap Kings. They're awesome. And we're going to have our special guest, Steve Martin. He's a banjo player of some repute. You might have heard of him. And we're also going to have a set for the first time, and we're going to have a film to show, and we're going to have some other visual elements that we normally don't have. But it's going to be, you know, wait, in your face. If you've ever, like, been listening to it at home and thinking, I would love to see the sweat beating on Peter Sagal's bald head, now will be the time.
Peter Sagal, I know I have to let you go, but this has been a total pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you, too.
That's Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR show that airs every weekend here on WYLL. And you can see their live cinema event tonight at the Savoy 16 and at movie theaters across Illinois and these United States. To hear an extended version of our interview, which includes Peter Sagal's favorite dirty joke he's ever told on NPR, visit our website, will.illinois.edu. You're listening to WYLL.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items to remember special days with personalized huggies, keychains, cameras, and more. A complete online catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
Silver bell, silver bell.
Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks has a debut solo album and a whole new sound.
I loved what we created and how we sounded together, but country music was never where I would have guessed I would have been.
A Chick Takes Flight, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 2nd of May, 2013. It was on this date, 1536, Anne Boleyn, the second wife of King Henry VIII, was arrested for high treason, adultery, and incest. She was intelligent, outspoken. She'd been raised in France. She had educated opinions about politics and religious reform. She came to the court when she was 20 years old to serve as lady-in-waiting. She soon caught the eye of the king, and for 7 years, he courted her, and for 7 years she put him off. He managed to get his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled by breaking with the Pope, declaring himself head of the Church of England. And then Anne Boleyn consented to marry him. Their early months of marriage were happy ones. Their first child, a girl born in 1533, Elizabeth Anne, had several miscarriages after that, and she never gave Henry the son that he so desperately wanted. So he accused her of every capital offense he could think of, affairs and incest with her brother and plotting his murder and witchcraft, and she was convicted and sentenced to death, beheaded by sword. In her last letter to Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn wrote, "Your Grace's displeasure and my imprisonment are things so strange to me that what to write I am altogether ignorant. Never a prince had a wife more loyal in all duty and in all true affection than you have ever found in Anne Boleyn. But if you have already determined of me, and that not only my death but an infamous slander, then I desire of God that he will pardon your great sin herein, and likewise my enemies, and that he will not call you to account for your unprincely and cruel usage of me at his general judgment seat, where both you and myself must shortly appear." It's the birthday of Dr. Benjamin Spock, born in New Haven, 1903, author of the Common Sense Book of Baby and Child Care, which came out in 1946, which began, "You know more than you think you do." It was the parenting Bible for the post-war moms and dads raising the baby boomer generation. It's the birthday of Jerome K. Jerome, born in Walsall, England, 1859. It was he who said, "I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours." And it was on this day, 1885, Good Housekeeping magazine went on sale, offering housekeeping tips, parenting advice, product reviews, and fiction. The Good Housekeeping Experiment Station tested and evaluated consumer goods, and products that passed were given the Good Housekeeping seal of approval, which became part of the language. Here's a poem for today by David Lehman, Sin City. Cynthia was feeling sinful in Cincinnati. She had changed her name once, which was a pity. She was looking for a new name, but not necessarily a new flame. Was there a sir to sin with? The evening was a blur to begin with. Came the first day of spring, and in the trees birds sang, enacting one of life's mysteries. The wind played and the clouds wandered like the lonely poet in Wordsworth's poem. Did she know it? What was the meaning of her laughter? That depends on